Well, until the slideshow gets going, I think first I'd like to thank Brilliant with an E for the opportunity to come here, and thank you all for being here. Also want to thank, there's two people on the table right here. I was hitchhiking here this morning. They gave me a lift. Peter, thank you, both of you. It was raining out, you know, it was getting kind of wet out there, so I appreciate the lift. Well, if you can't hear me, it's because I'm also Bryce James, too. I come from an English heritage, and I come from a long line of English mumblers. And I've been working on taking some Korean recently until I just realized the reason why I was doing that was because I could never speak Kiwi after hearing Jim speak, so I had no idea what he was really saying. So I'll stick to Korean before I figure out how to speak Kiwi there. But the first part of the discussion, once we get to the proper slide here in a minute, is also, if I do start mumbling a lot or talking too fast, which I'm notorious for both, people call my presentation drinking from the fire hose. I start relatively slow, but then I build up in a whirlwind, so you need to put your hand up or yell or something to slow me down sometimes. So what I'd like to discuss is, you know, what is portfolio construction? What is the evolution of these asset allocation models? How do we come up with what we started with? How did we get to where we are today? And I do a lot of myth-busting myself. So first, what is asset allocation? Will be the core issue of what I'm going to discuss. What are the flaws in modern portfolio theory? I'm going to upgrade modern portfolio theory and then basically show you how to build these models. I'm a little concerned I might have the wrong slide deck here, but let's give it a go and see what happens. So the first one, you know, what is asset allocation? So let me just kind of get into that mechanism. We realize, if we believe what we've been told, that 91.5% of variation return is due to asset allocation. You know, whether that's true or not, hard to say. You see this quote all the time. I know Gary Brinson, and it's quite an old stat, but yet we still hang on to it. What's humorous is when you see this quote in the States, they take out the word quarterly. They shorten it up. Well, if you take the word quarterly out, it changes the math completely. It turns out to be about 68% of your variation return is due to asset allocation. So it's funny how people take a stat and completely convert it, and I'll show you several examples of that throughout the session. The other thing that's kind of interesting is there's been lots of studies to this effect. The part that's most important to me is even if it's 68% instead of, you know, the 91.5 is still a very important piece of the process. And it seems, for some reason, in the States, we've totally forgotten about asset allocation. At a conference that Bob heard me speak at earlier this year, there was not a single person in the room that could tell me what makes an asset allocation model work. And yet, yesterday, listening to Tim Farley speak, you know, it seemed like there was a whole room of people. So in some ways, you're much more advanced. Our market's almost become, I call it Jerry Springerism. You know, everything's dumbing down. And the investment business in the States is coming, you know, basically going the same direction. So it's amazing to see the lack of knowledge in asset allocation, yet that's where we claim all the risk and the return lies. And so we fight ourselves for portable alpha, trying to squeeze that last little nickel out of every trade or transaction costs, and yet instead of paying attention to the bigger picture, asset allocation, it's almost completely ignored. So, you know, there's been lots of studies over the years that show that the right combination of assets will basically create a much higher return over a certain time frame. In this case, three times the returns over a 10-year period. A more recent study about 2 years ago showed, as you guys know, 401ks, similar to your supers, right, that 62% of all 401k plans in the States don't even offer enough choices to do a basic asset allocation model. You need about 12 securities at minimum. What's amazing in the States is you'll get one fund family that will sell a firm on their style, so it's all a top-down or a bottom-up strategy, and there's no choices to speak of. I understand here if you go to look at your fund choices, there's a huge offering choice, but in the States, 62% of them don't even offer enough fund choices, meaning eight or less funds to choose from to make a decision, and you need at least 12 to do a basic asset allocation model. So the study that came out was, over a 20-year period, the average person affected about a 300% loss in terminal wealth over that time frame by not having the right choices. And so instead of trying to figure out Social Security in the States, our goal as a company was to create newer generation of asset allocation solutions so we can help power the financial independence of people so when they want to retire or go off and do their own thing, they'd be able to do so with financial independence. So we didn't feel that taking 100 less your age. Do you guys have that here? Where you take 100 less your age is how much you should put in equities? This is a very common belief in the States, that you should take 100 and less your age, and that's how much you should put into equities. That's a real scientific way of measuring your asset allocation. But they improved it. Money Magazine a year and a half ago came out with a new study. It's now 100 to 110 less your age. So that's what you get. And that's how the it sounds hard to believe, but this is the level of sophistication. You know, it's all dumbing down of investments. So what is portfolio optimization? Portfolio optimization is a quantitative approach, a mathematical approach, if you will, of doing an asset allocation model. So instead of taking 100 less your age or going with the revered 60-40 mix in the States, which you call your balanced funds here, what we do is basically take a mathematical approach, and we just need four things. How do we, how do you calculate risk? How do you forecast returns? How do you diversify assets? And how do you handle data? And it's this fourth one that's by far the toughest part of the equation, and it's the least talked about. So if you're doing technical analysis, let's say, people say, well, I'll use this MACD with a 12-26, 9-day smoothing average, blah, blah, blah. But if you use the wrong time frame of data, the numbers totally change. And so it's the time frame of data and how you handle that data, which I'll kind of give you some hints upon of what we do. And so with these four attributes, risk, return, diversification, and how you handle data, there's basically, the way it works is there's a three-step process to take those four elements to get to the end. And the first thing you do is you take your distribution of returns, the number of up days and down days, and then how high the ups and downs are, and you build a frequency distribution, and voila, you have the famous bell curve. And with that, you could take a mutual fund. What's the jargon here for a mutual fund? Managed fund, thank you. So you take a managed fund. I'm learning all the jargons. Geared, that's my favorite one. We don't have geared. We have leverage, right? And so you get a lot of different words. So I'm speaking Aussie pretty soon. I'll work on it. So much easier than Kiwi. And so you run a univariate model, and all you're doing is you're taking that managed fund and you're calculating the risk and the return of that fund, plain and simple. And the way we've historically done is we build a normal distribution, and the more variance in that return, the more risk. And the average return over that time frame, whatever that time frame is your average of that time frame is your return. So risk and return. So that's called a univariate model. The next phase is then to look at the relationship between security A and security B using linear correlation. Correlation. Okay, everybody's heard the term. And if you build a matrix of ABC securities against ABC securities, you end up with a correlation matrix. And that's how we handle correlation. That's called a bivariate, two securities compared to each other. And eventually, once you start kind of multiplexing, adding on additional securities, that creates the efficient frontier, and that's the multivariate model, and you basically now have your whole bailiwick on building an efficient frontier. Simple so far? Great. I didn't give you time to answer, luckily. I'm not going to have that electronic key thing working. So what are the flaws? Well, in the States, this is what we show all the time. And there's 20 different versions of this particular slide. And Laszlo Borini actually calculated there's zero mathematical probability of determining which of the best asset classes would be in the next time frame using historical data such as this. And yet this is what we bank our style box analysis on. So I'm going to beat up on style box a bit. And so imagine you have equities, and you have to figure out, do I want to go large cap, mid cap, small cap? Well, that's okay. What was wrong with just stocks, bonds, cash? Now I got to figure out if they're large cap, mid cap, small cap, right? Oh, wait. Now I got to figure out if they're value, core, or growth. Okay. And then, we have international and domestic and emerging markets. And pretty soon you kind of have this Rubik's Cube of choices, and you're supposed to know how much money to put in each one of those little cubes and when to go in, when to get out. It becomes complex. And if that's not complex enough, we add in the fixed income element, which has its own set of variables. And then you throw in the alternatives and the, just speaking about, say, the commodities or the real estate, and then you get into all the hybrids of the hedge fund worlds and the the options and futures and everything else you could be doing, and it gets really complex. And yet these models are supposed to tell you how you're supposed to allocate to each one of these little tiny boxes based on historical performance, which is the funniest part of the whole thing, because in the States, I don't know if you have the same quote, but past performance is no guarantee of future results. It's on every single publication. And yet that's exactly what these models do. It's sort of like a farmer's almanac, right? It takes this long history of data and says, historically, this is what it's done, so therefore it's got to do it in the future. And that's what we rely upon. So hopefully before we get too far down the road, I'll show you how to make a Doppler radar out of it instead of a farmer's almanac. So getting back to the style box issue, if you take the top quartile managers in a three-year period, the question is, where were those three back 3 years before? So I built Drexel's consulting, Drexel Burnham, everybody, Mike Milken days. I built their consulting services in the early 80s. And when we're writing this software, it was trying to figure out how to standardize performance measurements. So, you know, some guys would use time-weighted, dollar-weighted. You could cheat like crazy on your returns. And so we're trying to standardize that and build these performance reports. And what happened was the start of this consulting industry really started putting people into boxes. And if you decided you want to change out of that box, if you didn't want to be a large cap value because you think it's going to go to small cap growth or something, you really couldn't do that very well because the consulting firms would fire you and say, oh, you have style drift and this and that. And so you couldn't move. It's, in the States, you know, Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, he's trying to shoot the cans and he can't hit a single one. But as soon as he says, hey, can I move, you know, he's hitting them. Well, this is kind of where the active managers come in. They can do what they need to do. But otherwise, it's become really a static, put you in a box type thing. So the problem with that, in the States at least, and I don't know how it is here, but once you put somebody in a box like that, if you think, wow, how would I have done the previous 3 years? Well, let's just look at where they came from. So the best performing managers for that three-year period came from the bottom quartile. But if I'm the compliance officer at the firm and I want to go hire this guy who's in the bottom quartile thinking they're going to do great going forward, what if they don't work out? And then they come back and say, well, you knew they were terrible. Look at their past 3 years. And you have a lawsuit ready. So it just by default, it's a flawed system of how we do consulting to some degree. And unless you have full reign over the asset allocation decision, this is what frequently happens in the States. If we look at where they go going forward, there's the top quartile managers, and look how many stay in the top quartile. Now, the chart at the bottom is actually a hedge fund portfolio, and it shows top quartiles of this hedge fund sector, and it showed how many stayed from 1 year to the next, to the next, to the next in quartiles. And you can see by the original top quartile in year one, 93, none were there by the end of the fifth year. It's a style drift. You know, it goes away, and it's again, we keep putting people in these boxes so they can't move and can't do what they want to do. And so it's there was a study by Fama and French that showed that in periods using more than 3 to 5 years, you have a greater chance of underperforming than outperforming. And yet Morningstar makes a huge amount of money with the style box analysis, and it just simply doesn't work. And so we have to question why. I was in a meeting here in 2 days ago, and this guy just kept peppering me answers. Why this? Why that? Why do you do it this way in the States? Great questions. In the States, it seems like we forgot to ask why. And so I really felt great to have somebody ask the questions, well, why this and why that? So I'll find out real soon here if I have the right slide deck, so give me 1 second. So here we have this efficient frontier of stocks and bonds. And let me see if let me go up one. So the question is, how did we come up with the 60-40 mix, or what you would call your balanced mix? Does anybody have an idea where that came about? Anybody want to give it a go and be bold? Pardon?
Recent history.
Well, originally, it was designed in 1952 as his first paper, Markowitz in 59, and first application in 62 with Sharpe on CAPM. And so what they did was they went and took 10 years of data. Markowitz tried to use estimated earnings and growth rates and dividend growth, but how do you get that information without fax or emails? Pretty tough, right? So, and we didn't have the data system to pull that stuff in, so basically he went and took this past historical data, which was 10 years, And he took this 10 years of data and extrapolated outwards, because that's what he has, the mean variance. It's the average of 10 years. So you can imagine what you think that would do going forward. All right? And so what we really have was a lack of computing power, which has caused this whole nightmare and hellish issue that we have right now with a lot of these models. So for you to calculate the risk and the return and the correlation of every single one of these securities, and let's say back then it was only the U.S. market, that's all we could see back in the 60s, it was 3.9 million calculations to figure out the risk, return, and correlation of the U.S. market. Well, that had a problem. Not everybody had a supercomputer the size of their house in their property. And so what CAPM came along and did was it created an ability to make a shortcut. So let me try to give you a brief glimpse of how that worked. If you could create an index, let's call it the S&P 500 index, is what they basically created to represent the U.S. stock market, well, then you'd only need to see how volatile a security was to that index. And beta was born. And so by using this idea of correlation, of looking at the relationships of these things, he was able to now negate a lot of the calculations and go from 3.9 million calculations to 2,701. It was a shortcut. And years later now, they've proven that you actually take more risk than reduce it using beta. It's because you're using something that is a kind of an indicator on an index which doesn't really represent the market. It's just too removed. And so even in a recent article I just read on the plane coming over here, William Sharpe was interviewed, and he said, hey, it was just an approximation. It was a theory. It doesn't really work. And yet we still teach this at every major university, including Wharton, in the U.S. It's crazy. So we still teach this idea of the efficient market theory. The efficient market theory is quite an odd concept. If you look at how it was created, it was the idea of the efficient market came from a fair back in the turn of the century. And there was these raffle tickets being given out. And they said, hey, if you can guess the side of the weight of this beef, fully a big old steer, fully dressed, you win the prize. And so these people bought these tickets, and they put in what they thought was the weight. And there's like 600-700 people-ish that bought tickets. And sure enough, they added up the tally, and within 2% of the actual weight of that cow, they were correct. So the markets, the whole must be the whole must be correct, and that's the efficient market theory. So the hotel I'm staying at, there's a butcher downstairs, and I go down there and say, hey, how much is the weight of a fully dressed steer? You know, he goes, you want just the half hanging here, or do you want the whole thing? I said, well, I want the whole thing. And so I was thinking about doing a little study today. What if I asked you all what the weight of one of these steers, fully dressed cows, you know, to buy off one of these big old hanging racks would be? I would bet that nobody would get within 2%. Back then, it was probably the butcher buying lots of tickets, or it was, you know, they lived on, I mean, it was agriculture was a very important part of this country fair. I'm sure they knew a lot more about what the weight of a cow is. Today, I wouldn't have a clue on what it weighed. I was so far off, I wasn't even close of what the butcher told me. That's 220 kilos, by the way. So the idea of the efficient market theory is that's what we've hung our hat on, was a street fair or a county fair. So these are the things I want to go through really quickly. So how we came up with the efficient frontier was, if you take the risk-free rate of return for, I'm sure all this is old news, but you take the risk-free rate of return where it intersects on the outermost part of that curve, that's supposedly the best mix. And in 1960, it was 60-40. Anything to the right of that line would be that let's say if you want a portfolio that's half that risky, you'd put half your money in cash and the other half in that 60-40 mix. You wouldn't actually change on the orange line. You'd actually go up and down the blue line. If you wanted more risk, you'd actually, I get to use the word geared, you'd actually be able to leverage up and go the other route. Okay. So we talked about how the 60-40 mix is calculated from taking that 10 years of data. And so let's look at this period in the States of this green line where it says bull. That's the extrapolation he took, that 10 years of data. Now imagine what happened if you stayed 60-40 the next 20 years. That would be that thing called summer there, 20 years. By the time I got in the business in 83, you couldn't sell a stock to anybody. It just wasn't going to happen. And so you would have basically blown up your portfolio as rates went from 18% downwards. Actually, they were already at 4 or 5%. Then they went up to 18. So nobody wanted to buy long-term bonds. Nobody wanted to buy stocks because for 20 years, they outright lost money. So that's why if you use the wrong time frame, i.e. 10 years or 20 years instead of 40 years, the time frame you take makes all the difference in the world. And that's the other part of the equation. Sometimes I build these portfolios that are fancier than I am, so I have to slow down and wait till I get it all going the right direction. So if we think about the this line that we use, why is it a single line? Isn't that kind of crazy? Does that really represent the market, this two-dimensional line? Well, it's actually at least three-dimensional. On the right side, the side that you can see with the red and yellow and a little bit of green, that would be the market in a bearish state, whereas the other side would be in a bullish state. So the efficient frontier, because you're taking this time frame over a long period of time, represents the average. It's sort of like a clock that's broken. It's right twice a day, right? Well, the efficient frontier will be right once in a while as it's passing through from a bullish or a bearish state. Does that make sense? So the idea is it's not two-dimensional by any stretch. You can then take this and then you can slice it. And if you looked at the slice and pulled away the front, let's say, like a little lobotomy of the efficient frontier, you can actually see that as you move outwards, I mean, who actually has the perfect mix of assets? So you're usually down deeper into the efficient frontier. Down, you know, from the outside of that curve, you're actually down a little bit deeper as you're trying to get outwards towards the efficient frontier. So it's very complex. It's very multidimensional. It's the markets move. Well, when the markets move, you know, stocks go up, down. Okay. Okay. So why don't you tell me the question? I'll just repeat it.
Exactly. The question is, is it because the correlation coefficients change between different assets? Is that why you get the third dimension? Because the correlation moves.
The question is... is that due to correlation changing all the time? And it's everything. It's the stocks prices go up or down. It could be based on fear or greed. It could be based on earnings. Whatever it is, the markets are constantly moving. So it's a little bit of everything. It's humorous about the market is if, I mean, the Australian market has been amazing, and we've been heavily invested for years in it. And it's so constant, you can almost bank on it. You know, the problem is now you have 30-40% of your earnings are coming from offshore. That's not what's going to hurt you. It's going to be all the other countries that want to come and invest here because of this long-term track record. They're going to see it on their on this mean variance model, and they're going to buy like crazy. And the day something goes a little off, everybody's going to sell, and that's going to create your volatility, things outside your control, if you ask me. So it's really the market environment that creates this bearish, bullish state, fear and greed, behavioral finance issues as opposed to strictly fundamentals. So if we look at this idea of the efficient frontier, the efficient frontier, if you just take it by decade, just snapshots of the efficient frontier decade by decade by decade, that's what you see. It changes all the time. If you take it by month by month by month, it changes all the time. Because earnings, you know, the company stock goes up, it goes down, the portfolio changes. So the efficient frontier is constantly changing. Okay? So what's interesting about this is if you look at the periods like, say, the 60s and 70s, those are the brown and the orange lines at the bottom. I mean, look what's happened to that. It's you lost money for 20 straight years. It doesn't matter what mix you had, stocks or bonds, you lost. But what's more interesting is that the magenta line is since 2000. It's actually inverted. It's upside down. So what you'd think would be the efficient frontier is kind of bizarre. And so you're actually, the real question is, what if you have a balanced strategy? Okay? Where do you think you are in that state? And these are the little yellow dots represents the efficient frontier in the way the states likes to word it, the 60-40 mix. And you can see that only one decade in 50 years came close to the 60-40 mix. In the 70s, you took twice as much risk for almost zero additional return. Currently, you're taking more risk and getting worse returns. It's a dynamic market. And to use some historical perspective and base it on the future is kind of crazy. But this is what we do. So I'd just like to ask why. Why do we do it this way? So other problems we have is the data. You know, the old garbage in, garbage out. I met a fascinating guy, Ron Ryan. His firm's called Ryan Labs out of New York. And we're at the Santa Fe Institute, and we were fortunate. My client was a co-founder of a large software company in Redmond, Washington, a little company driving the software that doesn't work right all the time. And he sent me down there to the Santa Fe Institute. We were working on chaos theory models back 86, 87. I met this guy, and he basically told me that all the historical data that we use and rely on is wrong. Oh, you got to be kidding me. He goes, no, I'm going to write an article. So he finally did. He back-tested everything, wrote an article, publishes it, and what we have is this chart is plastered, either framed, poster, something, on every brokerage and research and insurance company in America. Everybody has this chart. Well, the problem was that in their bond work, they used callable bonds as their proxy for the long-term bond market. And in years where they didn't have a 20-year or 30-year bond, they would use the last year's bond, or they would just not put one in. And so imagine if you use a callable bond. Any bond guys in here? Do you price a bond to the call, or do you price it to maturity? You price it to the call. Because why would you pay big money for a long-term bond if they're just going to take it away from you when the rates fall? The difference is now a callable bond is being priced. If it's priced to the call might be half the length of the maturity. So if you have a 30-year bond, the call might be in 10 years or 15 years. Well, if you're pricing it as a 15-year bond, how does that affect your rate of return compounded over 68 years? So in other words, this bond yields really an intermediate-term price, not a long-term price. And so if you took the true 30-year bond, the rates would be much higher, and actually it'd make bonds look a whole lot more attractive, which they would have been the last two decades. And so we've over-allocated equities because the information is wrong. So he submits this letter into the Journal of Finance in 92, and the illuminary Lawrence Siegel and his buddy Lummer write back in a three-page rebuttal, only a very naive investor would use our 20-year cost of maturity as a benchmark for evaluating a diversified bond portfolio. Well, that makes you feel good. And then they go further saying that he's correct in saying that an asset allocator could be fooled by the Ibbotson data into underweighting in bonds. But it's a danger only if the asset allocator literally believes that the historical returns will be repeated. Well, it's mean variance optimization. It's taking historical data. Work with me on this one. They call me three times in one article. They call you naive for using their stuff. But yet it's still, you know, Ibbotson, baby. It's the U.S. Ibbotson. They think of asset allocation as Ibbotson. It's like Kleenex. There isn't anything other than Ibbotson. I mean, somebody else could possibly do this. There's actually 50 companies in the world that do asset allocation. And most of them still use the original modern portfolio theory. The next generation gets a little bit more complex, but I'll get into that in a minute. And so a lot of people claim that Fama is still this father of the efficient frontier market. He reversed that a decade ago in the capital markets, too. And so, you know, it does. Returns vary with time. So in Sharpe's latest thing, he even includes that what you basically have is tail risk that is not being talked about. Everybody familiar with outliers, fat tails, black swan events. Anybody read Nassim Taleb's books, Fooled by Randomness or Black Swan? No hands up? One. We got a winner. Well, in here, it's funny. He talks about how these extreme events occur that can wipe out your whole portfolio, and he loves to bash all investors, so it's not a book I recommend. But he talks about a saying that everybody used to say in the UK. And he said, I'll believe that when I see a black swan. And that was just a common common. Always, oh, yeah, I'll believe that when I see a black swan. And then they ship all you guys over here, and the first thing they see is a bunch of, you know, it's incognito, it's a black swan. And so much for the old prose, you know, about the black swan. They existed. And it was right here in the Australia. So the issue is tail risk is a big thing. I'm going to show how we can fix that. And so we think, I agree on very few things with Sharpe, but I agree that the capital asset pricing model is ready for a makeover and that mean variance doesn't work very well. And the new approach does not rely on normal distributions. So here's the evolution of asset allocation models. We started with modern portfolio theory. Then came CAPM, and then we realized, boy, there's a problem here. So Roland Ross out of U of Chicago came along and said, you know what, I think I can do a little bit of forecasting. I don't want to just rely on the past data. So they came up with this idea of econometrics. Has anybody used these econometric models? They're fun. Yeah, they're just what you want to do all night. It's, you plug in all this data, historical data, or any data you can on the economy, interest rates, inflation, industrial production, and that's supposed to help you then forecast what you think the earnings will be, and then you use that as an overlay on top of the modern portfolio theory, and that's called arbitrage pricing theory. Okay? So then what you do is you build out this econometric model bigger, bigger, bigger until you get the Black-Litterman model, and then finally you get to wipe all this stuff out and start all over again. So that's what I'll show, and that's called extreme value theory. Benoit Mandelbrot, who co-creator of chaos theory and fractals, he's coined this term, extreme value theory. So what you're doing is you're going from these very static models that are all based on historical, making them kind of semi-static with some forecasts with the econometrics, and then we're going to go all dynamic, where we go into a new era. So basically what we're doing is we're going from risk, return, handling your data, from these static models, and we're going to create all these new ways of looking at the same issues of risk, return, diversification, and handling data. And without getting into the fun words like GARSH, which is one of Bob's favorite new words, I'll explain a little bit more with pictures because it's a little complex ideas. So it's sort of like a car. If you take a car from 1959, in this case an old Ferrari, it has its attributes. You have brakes and you know, fuel systems and hydraulics and all these things. Well, the same thing is, over time, you know, you could look at drum brakes, but they'd freeze up, so then you finally came out with disc brakes, but then they had issues, so you came out with dual ventilated rotors, and then ABS, and then it just gets better and better. But for some reason, in finance, we're still using these old models from 1959. So all we're doing is taking the same basic attributes and upgrading them, okay? So we're not saying that markets are static, that they do change over time, and that they don't follow a normal distribution, and that past performance does not predict future results. What we're going to say is they're dynamic, that they follow what's called a stable distribution, which is a far different thing than a normal distribution, and that we can do some forecasting. Okay, if I haven't bored you by now, let me give you just a summary in pictures again. So we're going to go from remember the three steps, univariate, bivariate, multivariate, on those four data points, risk, return, diversification, correlation. Okay, so what we're going to do is take the normal distribution, the average risk and return, and then we take this correlation matrix, and then we do our Fisher frontier. The new school will say, well, look, at risk and return changes all the time. I want to look at daily data. And by doing so, you can actually see what the distribution looks like on a daily basis. So this mountain chart is actually what it looks like today in real time. Each one of those little slices is what, sort of like a rolling moving average, saying, well, there's a risk return of this thing, and you keep taking on and adding new days, so the distribution changes. And so you make it dynamic so you can see what it really looks like. And if that's changing all the time, then more than likely the other security is going to be changing all the time. So wouldn't the relationship between two securities change all the time? Make sense? And sure enough, it does. And so a little two-dimensional matrix just doesn't do the job. So you need to have a three-dimensional chart showing, hey, here's the relationship, how it's changing. So what happens to correlation during extreme events? Up, down, or sideways? What happens to correlation during big market crashes? Up. We got ups. That's right. So the old saying is the only thing that goes up in a down market is correlation. So if that relationship's changing, well, let's have a dynamic model that's changing. It's getting riskier, and the correlations are going to increase, and so therefore we need to change our mix. Make sense? Okay. So from there, you can actually do some very cool modeling, again, with Monte Carlo. If you try to do a Monte Carlo forecast with the old school, it'll make a nice little... It was hysterical. Last year, I was at a conference. I was on a panel with Ibbotson, Morningstar, my two favorites, in case you haven't figured that out, and a couple other firms. And it was the last question. I had just gone last. I'm sitting next to the moderator, and somebody in the back had read Mandelbrot's book on the misbehavior of markets and said, you know, this guy says that stress testing, Monte Carlo modeling is the most important thing in the future. How many of you guys do it? And so Mr. Ibbotson's guy said, no, we don't. And the Morningstar guy, this is pre-buyout, no, we don't. And it worked its way down the line. And finally, the guy right next to me from Zephyr Financial, which is a performance measurement software, says, yes, we do. Well, whew, at least somebody uses it. It says, build these beautiful charts, kind of like a landscape chart of, in a great market, it's going to do this, and in a modern market, your portfolio is going to do this, kind of like those insurance illustrations, right? That over time, here's what it's going to do, and it builds this beautiful kind of Terra chart of possible returns. Well, all it's really doing is looking at distribution, saying in a really good market, the right side of the distribution is going to do this, and so forth and so forth. But the strangest thing is it gives us the same returns we started with. So we just use it for marketing. Yeah, it's because you have a normal distribution that's using mean variance. Of course, it could tell you everything it's going to come back to, but it's going to give you the mean average over time. And I couldn't believe it. This is the due diligence conference on 401ks, for the biggest one in the U.S., and I'm sitting there, and I'm like, you got to be kidding me. You guys don't understand that basic idea. And so the idea that we want to follow is using dynamic models. So what is risk? Well, it could be the risk that you don't have enough money to retire. It could be a lot of things. But in our world, whether we like it or not, it's the risk of losing money. Okay? And how do we measure risk? Well, there's these things, standard deviation, semi-variance, value at risk, and expected shortfall. The last one's probably new. So let me show you. If we take the up and down days and the amplitudes of the ups and the downs, and we took that chart over time, and we turned it on its side, and we shook it, eventually things would come down and fall to the bottom. And it would look like that. All right? What we do is we turn that sucker on its side and put a nice little bell curve on it and say, voila, normal distribution. Now it could be skewed and have a little ptosis, but the basic shape will look like that. And that's what we do. Then we take this thing called a normal distribution, and we estimate the average return based on the average returns of all those data points, and the risk is, you know, how volatile it is within three standard deviations. Remember, 99.7% of your returns will fall in that three standard deviations. That's a big number, isn't it? 99.7 doesn't leave you a lot of leeway. So the way it works is you want to look at the whole variance. That's standard deviation. But somebody came up and said, look, nobody's going to sue me for losing that money. I mean, for making the money. I just want to look at the left side. I just want to look at the left side of that distribution. And that's basically your semi-variance. Everybody with me so far? Okay. Then these really bright guys out of J.P. Morgan came along and said, aha, my banks and insurance companies, they know they're going to have some bad days. They don't care about that. They care about the really bad days. I want to go back and move that marker from the middle. I want to move it all the way towards the tail, maybe out to 2.5 standard deviations, which represents about 1% of the tail. And that's called value at risk. Okay? So value at risk is what all the banks and insurance companies, they spun off, J.P. Morgan spun off Risk Metrics, 93, and this is what we use today as our measurement of risk. Value at risk, where you're looking at the tail loss. Everybody with me on that? Okay. So the typical pros would be, I have a 1% chance to lose 4.7% on a given day. And so this is like for looking for hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, fires, whatever. This is how the actual actuarial tables are built at most firms. And so what do all three of our current models that we use today have in common? What do those three charts have in common? Anybody? Bueller? That's an American joke if you've seen the movie. Okay. They all use a normal distribution, every one of them. So let's get into the real meat of what's going on. If you take a normal distribution is based on an arithmetic table. So let's just look at returns on an arithmetic basis. Boy, that's a big stock chart. Whew, been a real winner. You throw that on a logarithmic basis, so instead of going 1, because if you go from 100 to a 200, it's 100% change. You add another 100, now it's only a 50% increase, and so on and so forth, right? 33, 25, 20, all right? So it completely changes what that looks like. Risk models do the same thing. Imagine it in reverse. If you take one standard deviation, why is one standard deviation 68%, but by the time you get to 3, it's all the way, and 2 is 95, and then 3 is only 99.7. It's compressing because it's exponential. So by the time you get to 4 standard deviations, whew, that's not going to happen in your lifetime. 5? 1 in 7,000 years of trading. 1 in 7,000 is the odds of that occurrence happening. So let's look at a risk model. That market's sure risky right now. Don't want to get near it. You throw it into a log, and it looks completely different. It's the fact that we build our risk models on normal distributions is the biggest flaw, which follow the constraints of Brownian motion. So what you need to do is get rid of it and start all over. So I used to be a crazy man on weekends, and all my friends that were serious climbers or flyers or whatever have pretty much bought it. And here is the best climber in the world, and if you're exposed to the elements, you're at risk. And the same thing is true of all these things that happen outside the norm, outside the laws of probability. Who would think that the best climber in the world would die? You know, just not common. And so the real world's controlled by the means as much by the averages. If you listen to Philip Anderson, who's another Nobel laureate of more modern time as opposed to one from 40, 50 years ago, and that we need to free ourselves from average thinking. And as Fama writes, you know, life is nothing but fat tails. The reason why he says this is when he was studying for his PhD, he had this guy that he was who was his advisor, and that advisor was Benoit Mandelbrot, again, the guy who co-created chaos theory and fractals. This guy had been studying with Markowitz and Sharpe and all those guys, and every year he said, it won't work, it won't work, you're going to have these big blow-ups, you won't expect it. He's been banging on this bandwagon for 50 years. Long-term capital happens. Well, risk metrics. They were using value at risk. And he says, I told you so, but he thought for sure that was going to be the death of modern portfolio theory. But no, they still teach it at every university. The new math, which I'm about to show you, is taught 3 years ago. There's only 2 professors in the U.S. teaching it. Now there's 7. But if you want to take the course called computational finance, you have to go to the econ department. So they bury it over here. So you'll get actuaries that know what that is. But over on the investment side, it's still kind of lost. So then you think, okay, I'm done with my CFA and my AMCAs, all my big accreditations. I want to join the Global Association of Risk Professionals, or I want to go join Premia or some of these other high-end groups. They're still teaching this old stuff. It's just crazy that the education hasn't lifted. The UK is very advanced, though. So here's how value at risk kind of works, again, in a nutshell. You take a distribution. You can put a bell curve on it, and you can see that you stand to lose 4.7% on a given day. Okay? That's a 1% of the distribution being shown, so it's that's your VAR. And it's just looking at that density area on the right-hand side. All right? So what we're going to do instead is see what that looks like instead of under a normal distribution, under what's called a stable, a better fit, sort of like a tailored suit instead of off-the-rack suit. Okay? We're going to find that one actually fits. And so the stable logarithmic distribution kicks in, and it sees that there's another 7.5% loss that you didn't see with that normal distribution. Okay? There's another 7.5. So in reality, you would want to combine the two together to see what your total loss is at 1%, which would be 12.2. So that's called conditional VAR or conditional stable, conditional expected shortfall. Anytime you say conditional, it's like an upgrade. I don't know why they do this, but that's mathematicians for you. Okay, so you can see that it's a more accurate measurement on the exact same data as in this case. So what you see, this is a firm in the States that handles all the teacher pensions called TIAA-CREF, and we do some work for them. And the gold is what they thought their risk was in their distribution. We ran their data, and actually the red and the green were the two tails. So things that should not occur in your lifetime are in the red and green tails. Sort of like, you know, what's the odds of getting hit by a stingray? One, you know, seven people in the world in history, you know, what happened to Irwin. That's an outlier. Same thing, the outlier could be on the other side. Cordell Evans, perhaps. But, you know, these are outliers. Okay, no cyclists in the group. Let's try another one. How about Robin McEwen? Can I go with that one? Okay. So what's happening is if you take a distribution and you just look at the left side of the tail, on the Dow Jones, this is what the historical stock market of the U.S. has looked like in the red. This is under a normal distribution. The red bars is at 1, 2, 3 standard deviations. All right? When you run it again and actually look at what happened, though, it's the black. Big difference. The red is what they tell you it is. The black is what it really was. Okay? So we know at 5 standard deviations that happens 1 in every 7,000 years, according to the red team. But in fact, it happens every 3 to 4 years. The odds of that one thing way over there, the 87 market crash, 10 to the 50th power. Well, 10 to the 20th is 1 in 10 billion billion. So 10 to the 50th is equivalent to 1 in 3 lifetimes of the universe. Okay? And yet it happened. So this is how flawed the math models are for calculating risk and return, for that matter. So if we just look at the tail of that distribution over a 7-year period, those are all the events that happened in 1 7-year stretch that should never have happened in our lifetimes. And the odds of them occurring are quite steep. Okay? That's normal distribution's problem. That's why we need a stable distribution. And our goal is to try to get that out as fast as we can to everybody and make this a standard tool for measuring risk. So you get the idea. So the way you can actually plot it is if you take a portfolio, you can look at what you think the risk is under VAR, how much you think you should lose, and then you can plot the exact same data again under expected shortfall, and you can see how much more accurate the gold line is. So you would have had 12 losses beyond what you thought you could possibly lose with a VAR model, whereas with an expected shortfall model, you would have only had 1. And the loss is a whole lot less than those other guys took. That's basically your job, or costing you your job if you have that kind of a loss. So, again, I think you understand that my concern is with a normal distribution, we're looking at this average over a long period of time. The more you take long-term data and smooth it out, the more jello you get. I mean, there was a market day last year, June 6th, the market was down 6 points. Okay, whoopee, so what? But intraday, there's a 306-point price move. That is a big deal. You know, you can't see the volatility. And so with a lot of these models that use monthly data, you can't see what your volatility is. Much less daily data, you can hardly see what your volatility is. Unless you throw a VIX indicator on top of that, it's hard to see your volatility. And this is what you need to see. And so by having a dynamic model, you can see your volatility. So if we now replace this old school thing on the left, the Farmer's Almanac, we can see this is what a distribution really looks like. This happens to, I think, be a REIT. And so the idea is, 3 years ago, or 2.5 years ago, this REIT had this huge left tail. Terrible returns, nobody wants it, but then you can actually run new models that will tell you that actually it was a great buy, and sure enough it was. But you can see now what the risk looks like. This is what the actual data is, and the red is the red line is the best fit of that data, as opposed to a normal distribution. Okay, so this is where it gets fun. See if I don't lose everybody. Okay, so if we take a portfolio, I call this the Bay Area portfolio, the San Francisco.com portfolio. It has this huge value and then drops, goes from nothing to everything back to zero again. If you look at this portfolio, if we use mean variance, you can see going up to 2000, you think you're still going to make these 30-40% annualized returns with the dot-com portfolio. But obviously that didn't happen. If we take the time period after that, though, after 2000, and we try to measure it with historical risk measurement, so I'm just going to zoom on that area on the right, that's the volatility, so we put it in the distribution. So we know that if we look at the light blue line, it's the bottom of all those other lines except for the black one, right? That's expected shortfall. You can see how much better it is at managing the risk. But why do we have to still look at historical risk? Is there a better way to look at current risk? So there are several ways to look at current risk. One way, instead of just taking the mean average of all those data points over that long period of time, is to exponentially weight the data and say today's information is worth more than yesterday. Okay? And this is what Morningstar's asset management group uses, as opposed to Morningstar's style box group over on that side of the fence. These guys are up in Chicago. And so the president of the company, I'm sitting there with them a couple months ago now, and I said, well, that's a great concept. He said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, you're valuing today's information is worth more, right? He goes, yeah, absolutely. That's what you want to do, right? I go, well, that's true. So, well, that means the old information is worth less, meaning the odds, it's like the present value of a dollar. Today, a dollar is worth a dollar, but the old information is worth almost nothing. And so what happens is the odds of that old event coming back and biting you in the butt again is diminished, so you don't see it. So there's a problem with that. So what you need is a new method that actually has your cake and eat it too, that looks at how the distribution of data, how it's clustering. And so I'll use this analogy because I know Bob loves this one so much. It's like a beehive. I invite somebody over for a picnic. They get there and they say, oh boy, I see that big beehive in your rafters. Man, I'm really allergic to bees. Me not knowing anything about bees, I just move the picnic table to the backyard as far as I can, get away from the beehive. And he says, well, no, that's not really the answer. See, just because that's where the beehives are most of the time, meaning that's where they are at night, they don't come out at night, they don't come out in the rain, they don't like humid weather, I mean, they're pretty picky things. And when they are out, they got to go do a job, you know, they got a job to do, so they're around the beehive. So the being by the beehive wasn't what he told me was at risk. What I'm at risk for is if they're in the front yard, or rather if they're in the backyard by where I am. So is there a way to look at the volatility clustering that I can see not where the beehive is, like mean variance is, but whether where the bees are? That's what I want to know. I want to know where the bees are. So the bees are in the front yard, I'm in the back. My risk is a whole lot less than what they're telling me. That's how these GARSH models, generalized autoregressive conditional heteroscedasticity with skewness and kurtosis, I know you love that one. And so these GARSH models will allow you to look at the clustering of data so you can see kind of what's happening now. And so that's the trick of looking at how to best handle data. And so you can do one thing better. Now that you know the bees are in the front yard and I'm in the backyard, that's great. But now can you do one step better? Can you tell me, wouldn't you want to know where the bees are heading? Wouldn't it be great to put a little GPS pack on those guys and see where they're swarming to? And now if they're coming to the backyard, I'd say my risk is higher. Okay, and if my risk is higher, it's increasing. That's what the Monte Carlo is doing with a dynamic model. So you can have historical risk being measured in stable distributions. You can have current risk being measured with these GARSH models. And you can do some risk forecasting with the Monte Carlo modeling. So think of it as beehive versus where the bees are versus little, where the bees are today and which direction they're going with the little mini GPS packs. Okay? Whew. That was the fun stuff. Okay. I think that's the hardest one of the group. Okay, so if you could do the left side of the distribution, why not do the right side of the distribution? I mean, same effect, right? And so back to this illustration again. I look at distributions similar to what the other guy says. He could care less about the normal or the average. He wants to look at the tails. Well, I, too, don't care about the middle. It's like a vice. I mean, I don't want to look in the inside of the vice grips. I want to look on the outside of the vice grips. And so that's the part of the distribution that concerns me. So I'm looking at how much money I think I can make on a regular basis. So this is how we would model it. So let's see how I segue in this piece. If you think of a portfolio, let's say you have 30 funds to choose from. If you have the wrong set of funds in that universe, meaning they're highly correlated, it doesn't matter. We have several firms in the U.S. That wanted to grow very big. So what they did was instead of competing with the Vanguards and the Fidelities of the world, they decided to create all these new funds, inverse funds, leverage funds, or geared funds, and all these sector funds. So firms like RIDEX and Pro Funds. And then these guys started getting big. So they went and they caught themselves into, is that an okay word to use? They talked their way into these insurance companies that said, we want you to create variable annuity products that just use our funds. Well, it doesn't matter what combination of funds you could possibly put together, no matter what you do, you're at so much more risk with their family of funds that even the best combination of funds to reduce risk is still 2x to 3 times as risky as, say, the S&P 500. Does that make sense? So let me give you a different example. T.I. Kreff, that chart I showed you earlier, T.I. Kreff has probably the most conservative fund families you'll ever meet. They're one of the biggest funds in the world. They own a ton of real estate and huge bond portfolios, and all their models are very quant-driven. There's probably only one fund that comes close to equaling the fund because it's sort of a surrogate index fund of the S&P. Any combination of two or more securities, there's no way you can put together a portfolio that risks on the S&P 500. You just can't do it. So you could tell me, I want to be as aggressive as possible, you can't take more risk than the S&P 500. Whereas with these RIDEX funds, for example, it doesn't matter how risk-averse you want to be, you can't get less than 2x. So the real risk is in the fund universe, much more than anything else, the selection of funds that you choose. So within that universe, let's go back to the T.I. Kreff example, I can now dial that portfolio to be conservative, moderate, aggressive, because all you're really doing is looking at a binary number between 0 and 1. I want to be as risk-averse as possible. I want to be as risky as possible. And somewhere between there, you have slices. And if we create 5 slices, that would be defensive, conservative, moderately aggressive, aggressive, and very aggressive. And so you basically are defining that. So when I use these terms like defensive, conservative, moderate, that's relating to a risk level within that fund universe. That said, that fund universe could be way down here in risk level compared to somebody else. Does that kind of make sense? So what I'm getting to is you can now forecast and determine how much risk you think that fund universe will give you. And that's what this is doing on a monthly basis. And so you do the same thing on the loss side. But the additional thing is now you look at the probability of those occurrences. So in this situation, boy, the conservative mix this month, based on what's going on in our Doppler radar approach, is telling us we really want to be in the conservative mix. Well, if we go back up to here, the conservative gives us a similar return as the other ones, so you should be at the conservative risk level. And so what's kind of fun about these models is they're dynamic. You can now say, hey, this month I want to be in the conservative mix, but if my risk drops and my expected return goes up, maybe I want to go more aggressive. And it's dynamically managing that risk for you. So you don't always have to be that tight little moderate risk manager when you don't even know where your risk really is because of this long-term average. You can now dynamically go from more, a little bit more aggressive, a little bit more conservative within that fund universe. And that's not to say you have a bunch of options and futures in there because you're still constrained by that body of funds that you have in that universe. Does that make sense? Whew. Killing myself here, huh, Bob? Okay. So if we now know risk and return, and we've seen the elevated versions of the newer risk models of using stable distributions, and now we can look at historical, we can make it real time with the Garsh models, and we could do some forecasting with the Monte Carlo. Now we have an idea of the risk and return. That's the univariate model. Luckily, that was the hardest part to get through. This one's quite simple, the bivariate model. So if you look at the two wealthiest guys in America, Buffett and Gates, their stocks go in opposite directions. So Berkshire Hathaway is the green line, and the blue line being Microsoft. At the peak of the market, Buffett's stock was down 50%. They thought the old guy had lost it. And if you owned it, boy, were you humiliated at the dinner parties. Oh, yeah, I'm up 300% of my Qualcomm this month. And yet these guys were sitting there thinking I'm down in the dumps. It was a terrible time. His stock comes rallying back after the crash and doubles, and Microsoft falls in half. So they're negatively correlated. This is the whole principle between asset allocation, right, is diversifying assets. Well, I'll show you a different twist to it here in a second. So the idea is if you have two securities that are perfectly correlated, you'd be that little gray circle, right, because perfectly correlated, if you had 50% in each one, you'd be right down the middle. But because they're not perfectly correlated, that's what creates that little fishhook-looking shape, and that's the start of what becomes the efficient frontier by adding more and more securities. That's what gives it that weird shape that it creates. All right, so it's a great idea, correlation, and using long-term data, it's a great idea. But we already know that during extreme events, things get out of kilter. So let's look at those extreme events, those outliers, those fat tails, those black swan events. If you look at the dot-com blow-up, and you look at the 9/11 attack, what happened to correlation of those two securities during those time periods? They went to one. Natively correlated securities went to one. So here you're holding on to these natively correlated securities in your portfolio, and you're underperforming because you're not concentrated. And then right when you need them to kick in and do their job, they're on vacation because they're not working. That's a problem. And now you look at the world indices, they're all becoming correlated. We've been so little in the U.S. market for the last couple of years, and yet you look at some of the portfolios and how much we drop versus what we think we should drop using the older models, and it's, well, period. You have no choice. Everything, you know, correlation goes towards one. But the global economy is becoming much higher levels of correlation. It's hard to even find diversified assets anymore, especially those that will work during extreme events. So this is the problem. So in the middle of a distribution, if you want to look at the long-term average, you'll see that correlation on this portfolio is at 0.67. You think that's about where I want to be. But as you go to two standard deviations, ooh, it's going up. And at three standard deviations, and it goes up towards one. So, as you go through extreme periods, correlation goes up. Okay? So instead of taking some average over a long period of time and saying the relationship between A and B is 0.67, that's kind of a silly notion, isn't it? If it's changing all the time, markets are changing all the time, I want to know what's it doing today. That's what I want to know. And so we go from, in the world of correlation models, correlation is actually just a subcategory under what's called dependency models. And the easiest dependency model to run, you could run it on your computer watch if you still have one of those things, one of those old Casios, or you have your BlackBerry Global, you can do a correlation table right on it. It's pretty simple. But a more elevated version of a dependency model is called copula dependency, and that's what we find to be the best solution today. I think fractals will come in and replace it, but today a copula dependency model looks at the interaction in real time. Work for me here. Okay. So obviously we had called it something else when we first started building this model 5 years ago, but when the guy who invents chaos theory and fractals tells you it's going to be called extreme value theory, it's extreme value theory. Kind of sick of the word extreme, you know, everything's extreme this and extreme that, but that's what we have. So let me see if I can get this thing. This is not, okay. Okay, I'm sorry I can't show you the really fancy version of this one. Basically what you start with is two securities, and you can have them side by side. And you basically turn one on its side, flip it over, and now you can see the relationship between two securities. So if you had a dot in the middle, that would represent mean variance. That's the risk-return correlation characteristics of those two securities compared to each other. Okay? Once we realize that no security has a normal distribution, we get rid of it, and we go to a stable distribution, which is what you see here. Okay? If you take the blue dots, and you take the average of all those blue dots, that's your correlation. Okay? Which would be 0.67, as we mentioned. If you want to know where your correlation is today, though, that would be that little yellow dot. It changes all the time. So the reason why correlation doesn't work is because those are the actual risk-return characteristics of those two securities compared to each other throughout the whole year. See how much correlation changes? Now, if that clustering of dots was very lenticular, skinny and long, it'd be highly correlated securities. If it was going the other direction, it'd be negatively correlated. And if it's a circular pattern, it'd be neutral. Well, it's not quite a circle, the blues. Forget about the reds, the blue. And it's not totally lenticular. And sure enough, this portfolio actually has a correlation of 0.54. And so it's way in between. Come up with correlation. Does that make sense? Okay. So the problem is correlation changes all the time. I want to know what my correlation is today. That's what I want to know. I don't care where it was 10 years ago. Don't care. I want to know where it is today. So in the 60s, we had a show. Flip Wilson was this comedian, and he called it the Church of What's Happening Now, and that's what we belong to. We want to know what's going on now. We don't care what happened 20 years ago. And so once you know what the distribution truly looks like, and then where correlation is today, then we can do some Monte Carlo modeling to see where we think it's going to go, and that's the red dots. And you use that, and you think, wow, I'm going to predict out 5 years, 3 years? No. 3 weeks, yeah, sure, maybe a month, but it doesn't. You can't predict out long term. It's sort of like momentum. The car is going one direction. You can hit the brakes, but it's still kind of going to go that direction. We all know there's a momentum effect. That's all it's really effect with Monte Carlo modeling. Okay, so it's not the holy grail where you can go out there and look out forever. But where it comes in really handy is now let's just compare how you can make money with these new solutions. If you look at the blue lines, the historical volatility and historical mean return, you can see that the security DSV had a historical volatility of 8.17. Right there. And the security on the other side, the global 100 index, was about half as much. Right? Everybody see that? And the returns on a monthly basis were around 1% and about 2% on the other. So this security here made twice as much money with half as much risk. Using mean variance, that's what you're going to buy. That looks great. I'm going to buy that one. And nobody would ever touch this other security. But once you run the new models, this is what occurs. You see that the risk has fallen out of bed on the, what was the term you used earlier? You had when the kid throws a fit?
Spit the dummy.
A spitting the dummy? You're having a spitting the dummy. That was a good one. So what happens is using the new models, you'll see that your risk is actually dropping quite precipitously as opposed to using the old model where it's not showing. So the one's saying historically it's twice the risk of the other. The current model is saying, no, what was riskier is now less riskier, and what made less money is looking to make more money. And sure enough, the very next quarter, this was the single best performing asset class in the U.S. So you get into things earlier than the next guy because you see what's going on today versus what's happened in the past. So that's the business model right there for making money using these models. You see what's going on today. You get a little bit of forecast and try to get an insight of what's going to do best the next month, the next quarter. And I'm getting close. Okay, I'm slow today. I know I'm normally twice as fast. I don't know what my problem is. Okay, I'm rapping. Okay. So, and it's important to realize, again, I was saying how important the actual securities are, the portfolio. So this is the S&P 500. These are all the subsectors. And you can see any combination of two will take you more risk. So that's why it's so important. So the having the right universe of assets is important. The other issue, this gets back to the example I made with T.I. Craft. So this might be the T.I. Craft universe of funds. This is their most conservative mix I can do with their funds. This is a moderate mix, and this is their aggressive mix. But this fund universe is a whole lot less risky than that RIDEX universe I mentioned earlier. So it's a selection of funds to begin with that is a tremendous amount of the risk. If you have the wrong combination to begin with, you're in trouble. So what we do is create class of risk because the S&P went from an 18 down to a 6 standard deviation. So if your index that you're comparing to is changing all the time, how do you benchmark to that index? It's kind of a novel idea, but we do this. It's kind of crazy. So why not just specify this is the degree of risk, sort of like a hiking trail or river rafting or anything else. Why not have classifications of risk and then see how your portfolio fits into there? And so these are models that we've run. This would be with mutual funds or equivalent. And this is with exchange-traded funds. And this is that big down day we had in the States. And you can see ETFs, you still can't diversify down as much as the S&P, so you still have a day that is down, or worst case, or aggressive, down 3.3 versus 2.3. But you can see our conservative funds are down a fraction as much. And the portfolios were already anywhere from 20 to 45% cash before the market took its hit. So these are the long-term performances using this model. And so we're quite pleased with it. And those are the type of funds. Again, we have very limited number of choices in most of our fund families. That's all, mates. Thank you. Thank you.